When The Selfish Gene was published in 1976, the fact that its author, Richard Dawkins, was a relatively unknown biology professor at Oxford University didn't stop it from becoming an international bestseller and being translated into 25 languages. His book popularized the gene-centric view of evolution and caused a revolution in the way the general public has come to understand evolutionary biology. Then in 2006, Mr. Dawkins published The God Delusion, in which he argued against the belief in a supernatural being. It earned him a reputation as the world's most famous atheist. Now, in a new memoir called An Appetite for Wonder, The Making of a Scientist, Professor Dawkins offers insight into his own evolution from a childhood in colonial Africa to a celebrated career at Oxford. It's published by Echo, and I'm very pleased that it brings Richard Dawkins back to our show. Hello.
Thank you very much.
Isn't this book just the first volume of a two-volume
memoir? I'm afraid it is, yes. It was supposed to have been one book, and then when I got halfway through, I decided to split it. I wanted to have a sort of sense of achievement when I got halfway through.
Is it because you discovered you had a lot more of a story to tell than you thought?
Not really. No, I just felt I wanted to break. It was a natural break point, the publication of my first book.
The Selfish Gene.
Yes.
So this ends in 1976. This is kind of like the build-up to becoming a known scientist and author.
I suppose it was a big change in my life. I did become better known after The Selfish Gene was published, and it changed my life in that I then, you know, became in demand for journalism and radio and television and that kind of thing, yes.
Weren't you born in Nairobi when Kenya was still a British colony?
Yes, yeah.
Do you see that as an important factor in the way your life has turned out?
I'm not sure about that. There's nothing obvious there. There's nothing I can't point to being fascinated by elephants and rhinos and things because I never really saw them. If it did have an influence, it was a rather subliminal one, I think.
What had brought your parents to Africa?
My father was a colonial servant. He was a British Empire civil servant in the agriculture department.
Was this something that was a family tradition?
It was a family tradition. His father was a forester in Burma. His grandfather was a forester in India. All my father's brothers ended up in various parts, not ended up, but went had their careers in various parts of Africa, yes.
And your father was a botanist as well?
He read botany at Oxford, and then he specialized in tropical agriculture and went to what was then Nyasaland, now Malawi, and was called up to Kenya because of the war. He was called up to join the army.
So do you think that influenced your decision to pursue a career in the sciences? The fact that so many members of your family were in the natural sciences?
Probably, yes, but in a rather dilatory way. I think I just kind of drifted into the biological stream at school because my father had. I didn't have a burning enthusiasm for the subject until I got to Oxford, and then I suddenly took off and discovered an enthusiasm for it.
Now, why hadn't you partaken of the natural wonders of Africa? I realize Nairobi is far from the elephant preserves,
well,
but still,
actually,
if I were nearby.
No, yes, I mean, I quite agree with you. Nairobi, actually, Nairobi National Park is right outside the city, and it's not as great as some of the other national parks, but there's plenty of stuff there. So I don't really know. I mean, I left when I was two, so I suppose.
Oh, that's a good reason.
Yeah.
Were your parents religious?
No.
So you did not attend religious schools or anything when you
I did attend religious schools. It's quite hard not to in Britain and colonial Britain at that time.
Well, you went to what's called a public school.
Yes,
which means
private.
Private school, and they always had a chapel every day.
Yes, they did, yes, yes. Mine was Anglican, and it was compulsory.
You described the beginnings of your intellectual curiosity here. What were some of the events from your early childhood that got you thinking critically about the natural world?
I'm not sure I was that critical, actually.
Well, you write about early signs of skepticism that you showed, such as in an encounter you had with Father Christmas, Santa Claus, in this country.
Well, that's right. That's about the only example. That's a story that my mother told me about when I was one, and a man called Sam, dressed up as Santa Claus, and fooled all the children. And, you know, he was gave out presents and much ho-ho-hoing, and then he said, I must go and get on my sledge now and drive my reindeer, and went off. And I was the youngest one there, and I just looked up and said, Sam's gone, much to adult consternation. But that was an early flowering of scepticism, which wasn't really fulfilled later. I describe in the book various examples of rather a deplorable lack of scepticism, like when I was playing hide-and-seek with an African man, he hid in, I looked in a particular hut, and he wasn't there. And then I went and looked everywhere else, and then I finally came back to the same hut, and he was there. And he persuaded me that he'd been there all along but had made himself invisible. And I thought that was a more plausible explanation than that he was lying. So that wasn't a very good beginning to my sceptical career.
Richard Dawkins is here. We're talking about his memoir, An Appetite for Wonder, The Making of a Scientist. It is published by Echo. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So you were very young when your parents decided to return to England?
I was 8 when we left Nyasaland. I was 2 when we left Kenya, yes. So 8, you know, I do remember quite a lot.
Now, Nyasaland later became...
Malawi.
Mm-hmm. Those 8 years are very formative years in anyone's life.
I think they are, yes. They obviously have to be. And I look back to Africa with some nostalgia during my early years in England, yes.
Was there a culture shock?
I'm not sure about culture shock. The culture in which we lived in Africa was a very English culture, a rather anachronistic, a rather dated one. And we had servants and things like that, which you certainly didn't have in England.
And you probably had tea every day.
Tea every day on the lawn, that's right. So it was a pretty English environment. And I was sent to school for, I think, 2 terms, a very English boarding school in southern Africa.
And then you went to boarding school when you went to England as well.
I went to boarding school in England as well, a very similar school.
Now, why pack you off to a boarding school rather than just have you go? I mean, I understand the big class divide between public schools, the private schools, and the state schools, but why boarding school? Were your parents so busy that they...
I don't know. I think it was...
Were you so annoying they just didn't want you around?
I hope it wasn't that. I don't think it was that. No, I mean, my mother now actually feels bad about it, regrets it. I think it was just what people like my parents did. I mean, they didn't give it a second thought. It was just, it had always been done in my family. I rather regret to say it was that sort of family.
Well, you're right about the atmosphere of bullying in your school days. Were you bullied?
I wasn't bullied, but I witnessed bullying, and I write about how I regret not having done more to stop it. I think there is a sort of cruelty in children, not universal, but it's fairly common. And I now can't quite identify with the small boy who didn't seem to worry about other people being bullied. I can't understand that now.
So do you think, as an evolutionary biologist, that William Golding was onto something when he wrote Lord of the Flies?
I fear maybe he was, yes. I've empathized quite a lot with that book when I read it, and I could see how, I mean, it's quite insightful to think that the sort of atmosphere in which I lived in boarding school, if the constraints of adult supervision were removed, I could imagine that it could turn into something like that, yes.
Well, we see bullying amongst girls as well. So
yes.
Can I see a future book from you called The Bullying Gene?
No, I don't think I want to call it a gene, although it's, you know, that's not impossible. Bullying, I think, has become in a way even worse among boys and girls because it pursues them home in Twitter and Facebook and things, and there have even been some cases of suicide among school children because of cyberbullying, as I think it's called.
Mm-hmm. You also write about your love of Elvis Presley. When did you first hear his music?
At school. I suppose I must have been about 14, 15. And all my school friends were mad about Elvis. And
well, he was a major improvement over Cliff Richards and some of the other stars in England at the time.
That you can't deny. No, that's quite right.
A lot of Elvis imitators at that time.
Yes, a lot of Elvis imitators, and still are, actually. There's a whole profession of Elvis imitators.
Now, the reason I bring up Elvis is, didn't that lead you to become religious for a brief time?
Well, yes. I mean, I'd sort of been religious as a child anyway, and I was just kind of beginning to give it up, and I'd sort of weaned myself off Christianity to a kind of deism, believing that there must be some kind of creative intelligence behind the elegance and beauty of the natural world, of the animal world, which I was then learning about. And so I became a deist. And then I was looking at a shop window in my hometown of Chipping Norton and saw a record of Elvis called Peace in the Valley, I think it was called. And there was a record called I Believe. And I was stunned. Elvis was religious. I don't know why it wasn't obvious. Of course Elvis was religious. He would be religious given his background and where he came from in the Deep South. But I was amazed by this, and I thought this was a direct call from heaven to me via the divine Elvis. And so I sort of felt this was my vocation. It didn't last. I mean, I gave up religion altogether about a year later or a few months later.
Well, Peace in the Valley was written by Thomas A. Dorsey, and Elvis did pretty much a note-for-note version of Sister Rosetta Tharpe's recording of it years earlier.
You're much better informed than I am.
Well, I know a bit about that stuff, but the reason I mentioned it is I wonder whether if you'd heard Sister Rosetta Tharpe's original version, you might have been as moved.
I haven't heard it, so I just don't know. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, it's available. Just go to YouTube.
I'll look out for it.
Richard Dawkins, the author of The Selfish Gene and The God Delusion, has written a memoir called An Appetite for Wonder, The Making of a Scientist. It is published by Echo. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Richard Dawkins. He's written a memoir called An Appetite for Wonder, The Making of a Scientist. It's published by Echo. So then when you were old enough, you attended Balliol, is it?
Or Balliol. Balliol.
Balliol College at Oxford University. What can you tell us about your days as a university student? Did you get serious about science at
that
point?
I did. That was a big turning point in my life. In my first year at Oxford, I treated it pretty much like school, learning from textbooks and things like that. Then in my second year, I kind of got the hang of university education. It's not textbooks anymore. It's being a scholar. It's going to the library. It's reading original research papers. And I really took off then. I really loved it.
And then doing your own experiments. You discuss an experiment you conducted very early in your career at Oxford where you raise baby chicks without natural sunlight. What were you hoping to learn from that?
That's a complicated story. I was interested in how much a baby animal knows about the world in which it's about to live. How much is built into the genes? Now, a particular aspect of the world is what makes things look solid. Now, if you look at a solid object like a grain of wheat or your own fist, given that light normally comes from above, it looks lighter on the top than underneath. And I wanted to know whether baby chicks see that illusion, and they do. But more interestingly, I wanted to know if they learned it. So I raised baby chicks with light coming from below. So they had perfectly normal light, but every solid object they looked at was the opposite way around from the way it was in nature. Did the genes do it, or was it environment? The answer is the genes, because they strongly preferred the normally shaded figures of solid objects.
So this was a nature versus nurture experiment.
Exactly, yes.
And did that lead you to think that our hard wiring is more important than what we learn, or is it just our hard wiring is more important when right after we're born?
Well, no. I mean, it could just be chicks, or let's say birds.
How much can we learn from an experiment like that?
Probably not a lot. I mean, I think it's probably just a demonstration that it is possible to do that kind of experiment. Now, you could. It's ethically difficult to do experiments on humans, but it might not be too unacceptable to keep a baby in a hospital where the light comes from below during the time it's going to be in hospital anyway. I don't think it's been done.
There have been some wild children Their lives have been totally destroyed by the experience of being feral in the early years of their lives.
Some of those are myths, and they're called Caspar Hauser children because one of the early ones was a German child called Caspar Hauser. The Mowgli legend, the Romulus and Remus legend, there are lots of legends about it. I don't know how authentic any of them are.
Well, Truffaut made a film about one of them, but I can't remember the film. It was a long time ago.
Uh-huh, yes.
While you were at Oxford, you began working with some of the earliest computers that the university had. What attracted you to computer programming in those early years?
Well, I first needed it to do my research, but then I did get hooked on it. It became an addiction to me, the idea of setting out step by step the exact steps that you take in doing a calculation and then running it at immense speed. It was hugely attractive to me. In those days, you had to write your own programs. There's very little in the way of pre-written, off-the-shelf programs. So I had to learn to program, and I learned to program in both high-level languages and in machine code.
So if things had gone in a different way, you might very well have become a computer programmer instead of what you became.
Yes, easily.
But you lost interest in it.
I didn't exactly lose interest in it, but I recognized that it was a dangerous addiction and that other people could do it better than me, and I'm better off buying programs than writing them.
Throughout the book, you mentioned many of the people who've had an impact on your life, among them John Maynard Smith.
Yes.
Another was Mike Cullen.
Yes.
Who were they in?
John Maynard Smith is famous and was a great biologist, known for many things, a great character, a great stimulator of other people. Mike Cullen is not well known because he was too generous and altruistic. He was a wonderful mentor. Generations of students at Oxford owe an enormous debt to him. But he was so generous that he didn't publish much himself. And so he's not famous. He would have been famous if he'd put his name to the papers of the people that he helped, the way most scientists put their name on their students' papers.
You came to the United States and taught at University of California, Berkeley. The American university approach is very different than the one at Oxford or Cambridge, isn't it?
Well, in a way, I suppose it is. I mean, Oxford and Cambridge are very different from the rest of the British universities because Oxford and Cambridge have the tutorial system, sort of one-to-one tutorial, which is a rather extravagant way of teaching.
But you go to a large lecture and then you speak individually with your personal tutors?
Yes, and what you do with your personal tutor may not bear much relation to the lecture. The lectures are separate, and they're the same as at any university. They're the same as at an American university. But the individual tutorial is a 1 hour a week with a tutor, where you take an essay to the tutor, having spent the past week writing the essay in the library, nowadays using the internet presumably instead, in the library, looking at original research papers. You're actually following trails of research papers, not textbooks. So it sort of means that you become a world authority as an undergraduate on a narrow subject that you're writing an essay on, which is an amazing experience for a 19-year-old.
And then you came here, as I said, to UC Berkeley, a very different approach. Was it easy to adjust?
Well, not that different. I mean, the lectures and everything else were the same. Even tutorials, I mean, they had a system called individual reading courses, which students could opt for. And one or two students did opt for that with me, and I gave them what amounted to Oxford tutorials. So it wasn't that different.
At the time, the San Francisco Bay Area was a hot spot for political activism. You write that you're proud of your involvement with some of the causes. You got involved in the American anti-war movement.
Yes.
But you say you're also less proud of some others.
That's right. I mean, I'm proud of having worked in the campaigns of Robert Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy for the Democratic nomination in 1968. Not so proud, and in the anti-Vietnam War marches, not so proud of the sort of rather more frivolous things. There was a thing called the People's Park, which was, with hindsight, a kind of trumped-up excuse for activism for its own sake, in rather unholy alliance with Governor Ronald Reagan, who also fed on it. There was a kind of alliance between the student radicals and Governor Reagan, because they both... It appealed to both their separate constituencies, and so they were sort of using each other. It is my now rather cynical assessment of what was going on.
Ronald Reagan would point to the students at UC Berkeley and say, this is what we are against.
Exactly.
We must not allow this to happen.
Yes, and the students would play into his hands and vice versa.
How long did you stay in California?
2 years.
And then you left because that was the plan?
Well, no, it wasn't the plan. I was offered a very tempting opportunity to return to Oxford. And after a lot of soul-searching, decided to take it. It wasn't an easy decision, but on the whole, I think it was the right one.
My guest is Richard Dawkins, who's written a memoir called An Appetite for Wonder, The Making of a Scientist. How soon after you returned to Oxford did you begin working on the selfish gene?
I returned to Oxford in 1970, began working on the selfish gene in 1973, but then dropped it for 2 years and resumed it again in 1975.
You say that the coal miner strike of 1973 served as a genesis?
Well, in a way, it was sort of...
So you went from Ronald Reagan to Margaret Thatcher?
No, it wasn't Margaret Thatcher, actually. It was Edward Heath. But there was a sort of general, not exactly a general strike, but a big coal strike which affected electricity supplies. They were only available for about 3 days a week. So I had to stop doing my lab research. And I took the opportunity. In those days, I wrote on a typewriter, not a computer. I didn't need electricity to write. And so I started writing the book, which was to become The Selfish Gene.
How important was W.D. Hamilton's theory of kin selection to your ideas in The Selfish Gene?
Enormously important. W.D. Hamilton was a British geneticist, I suppose you call him, and who wrote two important papers in 1964, which greatly influenced me. And I based a couple of lectures that I gave in both Oxford and Berkeley on his work in 1966 and 67. And then carried on lecturing, and that formed really the fundamental basis of The Selfish Gene. I have my lecture notes from 1966, which rather to my surprise, I discovered quite recently. All the sort of rhetoric of The Selfish Gene is there 10 years before The Selfish Gene was published.
And then you also drew upon the papers of an American biologist, Robert Trivers.
Yes, a very important influence.
What did he suggest?
Well, he introduced a kind of economic thinking, opportunity cost economics. The idea is that the cost to an animal of doing something, for example, of looking after a child, is measured in what it has to forego in the way of future children or of rival children at the same time. The Darwinian imperative is to have as many children as possible. And it's an economic balance argument. How much should I give to this child as opposed to this child or as opposed to the next child who's not yet born? And this is straight economics, which Trivers brilliantly applied to evolutionary problems.
You write that the major reason for writing The Selfish Gene was to correct the public's misunderstandings about evolutionary theory. What were some of the most common misunderstandings that people had concerning it?
Well, in the 1960s, there were a number of popular books by Conrad Lorenz, by Robert Ardrey, a number of television programs, all of which made the assumption that natural selection is all about the good of the species.
You call it evolutionary panglossism.
Yes, that comes from Voltaire.
Yeah, Dr. Pangloss, who always saw something positive in even the most terrible things.
That's right. When people like Lawrence and Ardrey and many BBC programs, natural history programs at the time, interpreted what animals did as all about preserving the species. Now, preserving the species is a kind of euphemism for reproduction, but that's not what it's about. What reproduction is really about is propagating genes. Natural selection, it happens at the gene level. It's the differential survival of genes in gene pools. It's only incidentally about species preservation.
So you say it's a mechanical process which can only favor short-term gain.
Exactly. Natural selection has no long-term foresight at all. If the species is being driven extinct, natural selection has no say in that. Natural selection can't tell that. All natural selection can do is favor individual selfishness or other individual reproductive best interests.
People who don't believe in evolution, and there are still many, talk about how the perfection of nature would only be possible with a supreme being. But you point to any number of things that represent bad evolutionary design.
Yes, I mean the retina being in the eye being back to front is a sort of classic example. No engineer would get away with that. If you designed a camera with the pixels pointing the wrong way, you wouldn't get.
And then you mentioned the laryngeal nerve.
Yes, that's a fascinating nerve. It's a branch of one of the cranial nerves. So it comes from the brain, and it goes. The end organ is the larynx, the voice box halfway down the neck, but it doesn't go straight to the larynx. It goes down into the chest, loops its way around a big artery in the chest, and then goes straight back up to the larynx. Well, in a giraffe, that's a very substantial diversion. A very uneconomical diversion. Once again, any engineer would be fired if they did that.
But it's something that occurred fairly early as mammals developed, or even
pre-mammals. It goes back to our fish ancestors, where the equivalent of that nerve, the most direct route to the end organ in the fish, is indeed, as it were, south of that artery. And then as the neck lengthened in evolution, the diversion... The marginal, again, we're talking economics, the marginal cost of a very, very slight increase in the diversion was not that great compared to the previous one. And it wasn't worth investing in the huge change, the huge disruption to embryology that it would have taken to jump the nerve over the artery.
But you would have assumed, because so many other mutations have improved things, so that somewhere down the line there would have been a mutation.
No,
it just never happened.
It would have to be a big mutation, but whereas it only takes small mutations to slightly elongate the diversion.
The selfish gene introduced the phrase "survival machine" to describe the role of an individual organism in relation to one's genes. What do you mean by the survival machine?
It was a phrase that...
And to give the slip...
I enjoyed that. It was a phrase that appealed to me very much because clearly an animal is a machine. It has moving parts. It has a brain. It has sensors. It works all the time to do something. What it's working to do is survive, to preserve its genes. And the genes that survive are the ones that are good at making survival machines.
Didn't that phrase cause... you'd have an embarrassing situation with the Japanese television crew?
Oh, gosh, yes. The Japanese television crew... I also used the word vehicle for survival machine. I talked about a vehicle for the genes. The genes build their own vehicle, which is the body. I was interviewed by a Japanese television crew. They came in a taxi from London, in a black London taxi, and they wanted...
That's a long trip from London.
Yeah, it's about 55 miles. And they wanted to interview me in the taxi. So, but unfortunately, the interpreter who came with them couldn't speak English, at least not an English that I could understand. So they just asked me to talk ad lib about the selfish gene and survival machines and things. But then I said, but why do you want to do it in a taxi? And the producer, who spoke better English than the interpreter, said, but are you not author of Taxicab Theory of Evolution? And I couldn't understand what he meant, and it was only afterwards I realized that the Japanese translation, instead of saying vehicle, they must have said taxicab.
Now, we have very little time left, and I'm sure we'll be talking about atheism and related matters when you come by to discuss the second volume of your memoirs. But you have... gotten into a certain amount of trouble for things you've said about Muslims and you've said about women, although, and it's my sense in looking at those things that maybe you got a bad rap, but it's apparent that you enjoy being a provocateur.
I don't really, no. I make mistakes sometimes. I think the thing about Muslims you're talking about, the context of that is I was getting a bit fed up with Muslims saying how great they are at science and how you can find all the science you need in the Quran and things. So I wanted to make the point that although Islamic science was very good up to about 500 years ago, nothing's happened since.
And you said all the world's Muslims have fewer Nobel Prizes than Trinity College, Cambridge.
Yes.
They did great things in the Middle Ages, though.
Yes, well...
And people accuse you of being a racist.
That's right. Well, of course, it's not racist because Islam is not a race. I mean, that's a ridiculous fallacy. But I shouldn't have said Trinity College, Cambridge. I mean, it is true that Trinity College, Cambridge has 32 Nobel Prizes and Islam has about 12. But
I'm sure your colleagues at Oxford really appreciated that.
But what I should have said was, yeah, indeed, what I should have compared it with is Jews, because nearly a quarter of all Nobel Prizes, between a fifth and a quarter of Nobel Prizes are to Jews.
Perhaps you should just resist tweeting for a while.
Maybe I should, yeah.
Well, this book is not a tweet. It is a wonderful memoir called An Appetite for Wonder, The Making of a Scientist. It is published by Echo. You have retired from Oxford?
Yes.
Richard Dawkins, thank you so much for being on our show today.
And thank you very much.
When can we expect the second volume?
2 years' time.
Okay, I'm looking forward to it.